Hello, I'm Kasia Kuzmicz-Kowalska, and welcome back to Science on Trial and Error. It's episode 2 of our new season. But first, two quick announcements. Thank you for tuning in to our first episode and for all your wonderful messages. Your feedback means the world to me, so keep those messages coming. Also, based on your suggestions, I've launched a Buy Me a Coffee page. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support us in covering software license costs and expanding our project, you can find the link in the episode description. Expect to find behind-the-scenes snippets, short posts, and perhaps even a newsletter. While I don't honestly anticipate huge profits from this venture, I'm excited to explore its potential, so thank you. Now, let's dive into today's episode. Transitioning careers can be a daunting task, requiring you to navigate your strengths, your preferences, and practical decisions, all while grappling with the emotional aspects of the change. Imposter syndrome often creeps in, prompting you to question your choices and motivations. It's a challenging journey, but one that's made easier with advice, resources, and reassurances that it's okay to think beyond academia without feeling like a failure. I definitely needed to hear these things, and at one point, the message came from a stranger. Our guest today, Ashley Ruba, made up her mind to leave her academic career a little bit over 2 years ago. Frustrated by the job insecurity and political nature of academia, she decided to speak out rather than quietly fade away like so many others. Her decision to share her departure on Twitter suddenly and unexpectedly went viral, sparking conversations and requests for advice from hundreds of individuals in similar situation. Witnessing her journey unfold on social media, I was struck by one of her messages. "You have permission to quit. I know you may need to hear it, and it's okay to quit." When I started to think about this season, Ashley was on my list of prospective guests right from the start. I sort of expected that she will decline due to her busy schedule and extensive plus 40,000 following. And I was so pleasantly surprised by her interest. It's moments like these that remind me of the power of connection and the ease with which we can reach out to others. I'm so grateful for it. Before we start our conversation, here's a bit more about Ashley. She earned her master's and PhD in developmental psychology at University of Washington in Seattle, followed by a postdoctoral research fellowship at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. With numerous publications, grants, and awards under her belt, Ashley transitioned from academia to roles in user experience research and then human factors engineering, where she currently works with Artrex, which is a medical device company. Additionally, she founded After Academia to help other PhDs launch fulfilling non-academic careers. In today's discussion, we'll explore whether questioning your career choices can help you discover your true self, why exit academic career, how to decide what to do and where to seek for resources, what strategies to apply, what mistakes to avoid. But this isn't just conversation about career choices. Keep listening till the end, where it gets even more personal and insightful. And as a bonus, stay tuned for the true story behind the origins of human factors engineering. This episode is very meaningful to me, and I hope you find it equally engaging. Enjoy and welcome Ashley Ruba. Hi, Ashley. Welcome to Science on Trial and Error. I am very happy that you will be our guest today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So you are currently in Seattle, right?
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And how's your day going so far? What's on your mind?
Oh, it's going pretty well. My Sundays, I typically end up doing a little bit of work for coaching. I'm a full-time human factors engineer at a medical device company, but my side hustle, so to speak, is coaching PhDs how to transition out of academia, since that was a career transition I made a couple years ago. So there's lots of work to do on that front in terms of starting and growing a business, but it's really interesting. But that's usually what I end up doing on Sundays.
Yeah, side hustles always good on the weekends. I feel for you. So let me give a brief introduction about you. I mean, I will give proper one before the interview, but still, so that people know who you are. Please correct me if I say something wrong. Mm-hmm. So our guest today is Ashley Ruba, and she's a developmental psychologist by training. And currently working on many fronts. On one hand, as a human factors engineer, on the other, as a coach, career strategist. I really like this term. Founder of After Academia, which we will discuss, because this is really interesting and cool thing for people who want to transition. And also called the voice of the many, which I really like. Honestly, this was one of the reasons I reached out to you, because when I was leaving academia, I found your account sometime towards the beginning of your very public, testament to what you were going through. And it helped me a lot. And when I started thinking about changing the direction of the podcast, you were on my list from right the beginning. And I was like, she's gonna be way too busy. And here you are, and I'm so happy. So,
thank you.
I thought maybe we could start with talking a bit about your current work on the two fronts, and then we can go back in time a bit and talk about why you left. But let's start. Human factors engineer for a medical company, right?
Yeah, the company is Arthrex, and so they're based in Florida in the United States, and I live on the opposite coast in Seattle in the United States. So I work remotely, which is nice, but my company builds medical devices for orthopedic surgery. So orthopedic surgery being anything joint related, like shoulder replacements, hip replacements, knee replacements. And I am an engineer on the digital enabling technologies team. So we build new technology to help surgeons do their jobs better. So some of what I'm working on right now is preoperative planning software that surgeons can use to plan their surgeries. And then I'm also working in the medical augmented reality space, trying to develop new augmented reality tools that surgeons can use in surgery to perform their jobs better as well. So it's pretty cool. My work feels really impactful. And like everything I do is ultimately to the benefit of helping other people. And it's still pretty like technical, and my coworkers are great. And I really like my my job. It's very different than what I did previously and like in my PhD, but it's still research at the end of the day, which is what I've found that I've enjoyed most over my career.
So on a daily basis, it requires a lot of interactions with both the company, I guess, and the surgeons? Or are you just receiving some information from someone else? How does it work?
Yeah, so I work with other people at my company to develop new products. So usually there'll be a product manager in addition to any engineers or designers who are actually building the prototype of the product. And then once they have some sort of a prototype, they come to my team and we work with surgeons in order to test these prototypes with surgeons, making sure that whatever we're building is safe and effective for use. Fortunately, in my company, none of the things that we're building really have the capacity to kill someone, just potentially harm someone in some way. But like, we're not working with pacemakers or any like tools like that that could actually like kill someone. But we are basically doing testing with surgeons and getting feedback from surgeons about whether what we're building is actually safe and easy for them to use. And then assuming that, you know, we've found this and we've mitigated the risk of using our devices as much as possible, then we submit all of this to regulatory boards. So the FDA in the United States or the EU regulatory board in the EU to get them approved so that we can actually sell them in various countries. Yeah, so our team, we are interfacing with kind of everyone, but we are ultimately like the voice of the surgeons to advocate for changes that need to be made to our products to make sure that people can use them correctly.
That's really nice. I feel like working in basic research, which is what I did. And I guess you are also closer to that than to actual translational research that impacts people. It gives you a bit of a meaning behind what you do. And I guess it feels better.
No, definitely. Yeah, I mean, in my PhD, it was developmental psychology. So I was studying how babies learn about other people's emotions, which is like very important work to do. But the impact wasn't as clear because I'm publishing these really long research papers that maybe only a handful of people will actually read. And while I did want to get into the intervention and assessment space, it was still mostly what I was doing was basic research, and the impact wasn't as clear as what I'm doing right now.
So after you left academia, you worked as the user experience, the UX researcher, right? How different was that job from what you're doing now? Is it somewhere close?
Yeah, it's similar. So if UX research is like this big umbrella, like human factors is part of UX research, but human factors engineering has been around for longer. So it became more of a thing in World War II when plane cockpits became really complicated and you still had highly trained pilots who were crashing planes. And so instead of blaming these really highly skilled pilots, the engineers thought maybe we should just redesign this cockpit to be easier to use by taking into account like human limitations and trying to reduce human error as much as possible. So that's essentially human factors engineering. See this mostly in highly regulated industries like aerospace industry and the automotive industry and medical devices, things where you could build something that could actually hurt another person. It's really just concerned with making things safe and effective for use, but not necessarily like, is it fun to use? Whereas UX research, that became more of a thing, you know, early 90s when computers were becoming more of a thing.
And applications.
Kind of more in like the software side of things. So we are slowly like bringing more of that into our work because we are working with new technology. So there are software interfaces and people are going to be judging whether something is easy to use based on the user experience. Our team is actually quite new in my company. We used to contract out a lot of our engineering before, but now we are actually like are hiring and have like an in-house team. They are related fields, but human factors engineering, it's like a mixture of psychology and ergonomics, whereas UX research is much more social sciences in general. And if you have like a social sciences background or even humanities background and are like skilled in qualitative research, that can be a good fit for you. But human factors is like definitely more on the psychology side of things.
So you worked as a UX researcher at Meta, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how did you find that experience? Was it also a remote job?
So Meta has offices in Seattle. I could work at home, but I ended up going in a lot of the time because they fed me. So, like, I was a grad student, I'll do a lot for free food. So I would like go in because you could get like breakfast and lunch. And then if you really wanted to stay late, you could get dinner. But I usually went home before that. I didn't mind that. That's kind of like the only reason I went into the office. I joined Meta at a really weird time. I joined 6 weeks before they did their first round of major layoffs. Mm-hmm. And so that was very chaotic, as you can imagine. Someone on my team was laid off. I was
stressful.
Kind of like thrown into the deep end and was like, yeah, you need to finish his project. I've only been doing this for a few months, but like, sure. And I did it. And then last year, it was just like more layoffs. My manager was demoted, essentially. Like, we had multiple reorgs. Projects were getting cut. And it was just, I was a contractor and I didn't really see a path forward to
grow. Yeah.
I found the lack of job stability to not be great for my mental health, which was a part of the reason I pivoted. And my company now, there's no recession-proof industry, but like healthcare is pretty stable as far as things go. And my company, I think, is pretty fiscally responsible and has never done layoffs. And people in my company have been there for 10, 20 plus years. So it's definitely a place where people will stay and they want you to stay for a really long time. I don't see any reason why I would want to go anywhere else, honestly.
I think it's a valid point that you bring that I didn't realize until I now switched. I am still working proxy to academia because I work at the university, but I work as a project manager. And I worked at the research institute before that was purely research, very new. And now at the university, that's like super old. But I know people who work in administrative part for years. And I feel like kind of this calmness that if I want to, I could probably stay long And mm-hmm. I don't have to feel this constant fear in the back of my head. You have to move. There's the mobility pressure and all of these things. It's very important. And I didn't realize much it weighs on you in the back of your head. So I totally get it.
I mean, and that was like a big reason I left my postdoctoral fellowship in the middle of my third year, because it didn't really seem like, I could keep on for another like couple of years and keep applying for faculty positions. But I didn't know like if anything was actually going to materialize, or if it did, like where would I have to move? And even if I moved somewhere for a job, what if I didn't get tenure and then I would have to move again? And it just seemed like there was no guarantee I would get a job in a place that I wanted to live and then I would be able to stay there for like a long time. It always just seemed kind of like things could fall apart at any moment. It was like really hard for my mental health, because I really require stability and predictability, or else everything just kind of feels like it's about to fall apart.
I get it.
Yeah.
you brought up your postdoc. I had a look at your academic resume, and you could have really stayed in academia.
Oh, yeah.
And probably do well. You had the awards, you had the distinctions, mm-hmm. papers, everything was going well mm-hmm. on paper.
Yeah.
Still knowing how things go, you can look good on paper and still not get funding. And so my question is, why? I mean, you partially said the job instability. I get it.
Yeah.
Was it also about anything else in the culture?
It was a lot of things. I actually considered leaving academia at the end of my PhD program. I had sat on a faculty search committee in my fourth year and saw the process from the other side and saw how faculty were hired and thought, I'm never going to get a job, because we were like cutting people who had CVs that were like way better than mine. And the process, it was not merit-based, and it was very like...
It's not transparent. It's not really transparent.
No, and I was just, wow, I don't know if I really want to stay here. There was like a lot of pressure mm-hmm. to perform well, and I was performing well, but it was just like the pressure that I didn't like. So I actually looked at UX research careers at the end of grad school, because I was in Seattle. I did my PhD in Seattle, and there's a lot of tech companies here, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, like all of them are here. It was such a big departure from what I was doing, and I was studying babies. I'm like, I don't know if I really want to just... not work with kids and go to a tech company. And so then I applied for a fellowship through the National Institutes of Health, which was the fellowship that I got. Mm-hmm. It was the only one I applied for. So I took it. And then I started my fellowship at the end of 2019, so like 6 months before COVID-19 happened.
Yeah.
Had COVID not happened, because my original plan was to apply for faculty jobs in 2020 and 2021, I might be a faculty member right now. Like I may have actually done it and stayed with it, but COVID like wrecked the job market, all of my research stopped, everyone just having a really hard time during this period. And then when I was in my third year, my postdoc, it was like, I'm going to have to stay for a fourth year at least. And I'd been on the academic job market once, and I just really didn't want to do it again. And in my postdoc, I was starting to just see the toxicity of academia that I think I had been really sheltered from my undergraduate advisor and my graduate advisor, who are both were lovely and don't play into like the academic power dynamics. And then during my postdoc, I finally was seeing what it was really like. And just I was recently diagnosed with ADHD and autism. So I had like a very strong sense of right and wrong. And it was very frustrating to me. And I couldn't figure out how to play this political game to maneuver in the academic system. And I just was very frustrated with how people were treating me and how things were going, that I was just like, I just don't want to do this anymore. I was really unhappy. And yeah, it was like a long time coming. I just like hit my breaking point at some point. I'm like, I'm done. I'm going to do something else. I just can't do this anymore.
No, I understand that. But this in itself can be extremely difficult, because you are, on one hand, you are facing leaving what you already sacrificed a lot to do, because academia, you know, has its cost. And then on the other hand, you are facing total stress and shock and fear of looking for a job outside. What do I know that translates? What will work? And you decided to do it publicly, sort of, which I am quite impressed. I mean, don't get me wrong, I do feel like sometimes it's helpful to share because you get support, but with things like that, they can always be backlash. And I was wondering if you were already taking it into account when you decided to share it. I know you couldn't have predicted that it would become so viral, but what pushed you, or like, why did you get to this point where you decided to share it? What was the reason?
Like, deciding to like post on social media about it. Yeah, I think I was like on academic Twitter and kind of just lurking for a really long time and like wrote a couple of memes, but I had fewer than 1,000 followers. And I don't know, I just kind of felt like so many people I had talked to had just quietly exited academia. I mean, Quitlet was kind of a thing, but they weren't really like talking about it. I don't know. I just posted to be like, I'm just going to like let people know why I'm leaving. And I didn't expect that first tweet to go viral, but I think it was just because like no one was really talking about it. And then I think the people who knew me were shocked because I had given up so much for this career and had tried so much. And then I think other people who didn't know me like saw my CV and were kind of shocked. And I don't know, I just didn't want to like disappear quietly like so many other people had done. And then the reason I like continued to post about stuff was a lot of people kept asking for my help and I wanted to help people, even though I barely know what I'm doing, but like I'll try to tell you as much as I know. I just remember thinking like, if I were back in my PhD program and I had saw anyone just talking openly about how much they liked their job outside of academia, then I would have been much more likely to actually make that career transition. But because everyone I talked to was, it just like seemed really sad. It seemed like they'd been on the job market for multiple years, like nothing panned out. And then they just kind of got pushed out. No one I talked to really seemed to have made a deliberate choice to leave and then was really happy. There was always a lot of sadness and grief around it. And I just remember thinking, well, I don't know if you really like your job. I think I can do this. Like, I think I can be one of the ones who like makes it. Had I seen myself 2 years ago, I think I would have probably just left academia like in my PhD program and wouldn't gone for the postdoc.
So what did you learn about yourself through this process?
A lot. I think like the big thing was that I historically, I think, have made a lot of decisions in my life based on what other people have wanted me to do or what I've thought other people have wanted me to do.
I feel you.
Like wanting to be a professor because my parents didn't go to college. And so they just kind of viewed any kind of college education was amazing. And then once I was in undergrad and really wanted to do research, everyone was like, well, you should be a professor, because that was really the only career option that was ever presented for me. And I was, okay, sure. Like, you all seem to like your job. This seems like a really prestigious job.
If you're ambitious, this is the way.
Yeah, I'm very right? ambitious.
Yeah, it plays on like, you.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah, so I didn't question it, even though I never really liked teaching courses. I like really just wanted to do research. I didn't like the process of creating lectures and giving lectures and grading papers and like all of that. I really just preferred the research process. And yeah, so I didn't really consider other career options because no one was really presenting anything else to me. And instead it was like, well, if you don't become a professor, you're kind of just a failure. And I was like, well, no, I'm not a failure. I have a very deep fear of failures. But I think once I sat down and kind of questioned, like, why do I believe that this is the only career where I could be happy or the only career where I can find like prestige and intellectual fulfillment, started questioning that. And then I started questioning a lot of other things about various other aspects of my life where I'm like, why am I doing this? Am I just doing this because other people want me to do it? And part of that has been like, you know, being diagnosed with autism and just appreciating how much I mask around other people and slowly like trying to pull those layers off and be like, is this really how my personality is? Or if I contorted myself into this person because I think this is more palatable for other people. And the past years have been a process of pulling all of these layers off and being like, is this me? Or is this like what I think other people want me to be? I still am not quite sure like what the ground truth is about myself, but that's been the biggest thing I've been learning and unlearning the past few years.
Yeah, I understand it. I've been constantly questioning my self-worth ever since honestly, the PhD for me was really a rough patch.
Oh, yeah.
And then I ended up being diagnosed with a chronic disorder during, which also, you know, put everything into question. And I was like, what do I do? Then I found out that it's better if I stop working in the lab anyway. So I was suddenly thinking, okay, I failed. And I don't know what to do. Should I do a postdoc that is purely theoretical or bioinformatics? What do I do? And then I realized that I was taking all of my self-worth from my work.
Yeah.
So of course, feeling like I'm failing on that front, feel like I'm failing in life in general.
Oh, yeah.
And I must say, your posts, they struck me as a very, I don't know, they were building confidence. And I was very impressed because I felt extremely insecure in all of my decisions. And
yeah,
it's probably, you know, the way you phrase yourself, and I know you must have gone through this process yourself, but it really made me feel better. There was this one post where you said something like, I give you permission to quit. Yes. And I was like, finally, someone. I didn't care that I don't know you. I was like, someone is saying this.
Yeah.
I needed to hear this.
Yeah. No, I feel like a lot of grad students will message me and they clearly are just like really unhappy in their program. And they're just like, should I leave? Like, I don't know. Am I a failure? And I'm like, you have the answer. You know that you are unhappy. You know that you do not want to do this. Academia is such a weird bubble. And I have to tell people all the time, you actually don't need a PhD. In most cases, it would probably have been better if you didn't get the PhD from a financial standpoint. Yeah. And I'm like, I am the only PhD in my broader team of 15 people. Everyone else, master's or bachelor's, I am the only PhD, was not required for my career. Did I learn a lot? Do I have really good skills that transferred? Absolutely. Could I have done the same job with a master's and started my career back when I was 24 instead of when I was 32? Yes. I have had a lot more money and been a lot further along with like 8 years of actual like industry experience? Probably. And that's what I try to like remind people. The PhD is not worth it in almost every case, unless you like have the money and you have the support to go through it, or if you really want a career where a PhD is required, which is a handful of them. But I think most people just need someone to be like, you know the answer. You know you don't want to be here. It's okay. You can leave.
Yeah, and actually, this leads me to something I wanted to bring up. How do they call it? Which could be improved. In general, in the whole process and in helping people in this process. Because, you know, there's not enough space in academia to host everybody who's doing a PhD.
No.
There's not enough space even for everybody who's doing a postdoc, right? It's pretty clear that it gets very steep and it shouldn't be perceived as a failure, and people should be informed of the alternative career pathways already early on so that they can feel like these are equally good options for their career. However, I feel like the atmosphere within the academia to keep good people in, and also created by some other people around the internet, is to create fear and to install fear in people who want to leave. Either fear that you are not suited to find a job outside, or that this is somehow something that shows you as a failure or shows that you have no ambitions, or even that you cannot do it yourself or alone. And therefore it's safer to stay, or it's safer to lean. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of this. I find it very negative in some sense.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, what are your feelings about this?
Yeah, I think like it's interesting because there's some professors and some departments that do a better job of preparing their students for careers outside of academia. I had a lot of friends in chemical engineering. Almost none of them are in academia. They didn't necessarily have training to go to non-academic careers, but they had a much easier time transitioning than I'm in psychology. And a lot of the people I work with as a coach are in either social sciences, life sciences, or humanities. And it seems like those are really the areas that are struggling the most in this transition, especially people in life sciences who want to go into like non-biotech or like R&D careers. But I mean, even in my department, it felt like I was the chair of the graduate student committee, and the only professional development we had for non-academic careers was what I decided to create for. Created a panel and like led this panel for like other students, but like the department in and of itself was not doing any professional development. And I even went to the career center at my university, and they were just like really poorly equipped to help PhDs specifically. It was like much more geared for undergraduates. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be like super cynical about things, but obviously grad students and postdocs are really cheap labor for universities, and especially postdocs. The postdoc salary in the United States is $50,000 a year. And, you know, I left academia and I immediately started at like twice that at an entry level position. So you're paying like these highly skilled researchers not that much money, and then you're barely paying graduate students anything. But if graduate students didn't teach classes, the whole university would just completely fall apart. So as long as people are still wanting to get into PhD programs, it's just a supply and demand problem, and there's actually no reason for anything to change. And only now the federal government actually seeming to care about the postdoc situation, because so many labs are having difficulty finding postdocs.
It reached a huge crisis. So, yeah, but I mean,
if you look at like the federal data for the United States, it's still about like 50,000 PhDs are conferred every single year. And that number is not decreasing. It's continuing to increase. So as long as people are still wanting to go and get a PhD, universities are not going, there's no reason for them to pay anyone more.
I mean, in Europe, it varies. It depends country to country. You know, you have certain regulations. I would say I come from Poland. In Poland, it is just ridiculous. Like a PhD student have to tutor high school students to afford a flat to share, and it's just ridiculous. I totally get it.
That's kind of how it is here. Yeah. I mean, like I did my PhD in Seattle. Cost of living, it's like one of the most expensive cities in the United States. And over half of my stipend was going to rent. I was working multiple other jobs. And we even like went on strike at one point because the university wasn't even going to increase our stipend to keep up with an inflation. And just the amount of pushback we received from the university about this, they just were really not willing to pay us more. It was like very clear that they just didn't care and they were not going to increase our stipends. So that was pretty demoralizing, like going through that.
So where did you get support, or where did you find the resources to really learn about what you could do? Was it your network?
A little bit, yeah. When I had started talking to PhDs in Seattle, it was like a lot of UX researchers, but then I ended up getting on LinkedIn and talking to a couple other people. I knew that I wanted to do research, like as opposed to any kind of other career. That's what was most interesting to me based on, you know, my skills and my interests. So I did that reflection, and then I didn't talk to as many people as I wish that I would have. I made several mistakes, I think, when I was leaving academia. And one of them was I didn't really network that much, and I didn't pick like a single career to target. I just kind of applied to a variety of different research careers, which worked out for me, but it's definitely like not a very effective job search strategy. But yeah, and then I ended up taking the first job offer that I got because I was just very much wanting to leave academia. And then that first job, it was a true entry-level position at a small consulting firm. And after 3 months there, I learned a lot, but I got like really bored of the work because I was doing a lot of just note-taking and data collection, not doing any kind of study design or project management. And it really didn't seem like they were going to allow me to do that for a long time, like at least a year. And that just wasn't, I mean, I was getting paid a lot, but I was just really bored. So that's when I ended up applying to this job at Meta kind of on a whim, and then ended up getting it and leaving because they were going to allow me to do these things that I wanted to do in my job.
What did you find the hardest? Was rephrasing and kind of reevaluating your skills that you took from academia the difficulty, or was it more learning how to interview informally? And, you know, because this is something that people are really, they get terrified of. And sometimes you go on the internet and you find some resources, and the only thing you get out of this is that this is a lot, I don't know where to go, what do I do?
Oh yeah, there were a bunch of resources that I've actually like put together. I've made a list of them so far, and there's actually over 50 of them now, kind of like scattered in various places. So there was really no like central hub for information. I figured out how to write a resume. I think I still made some mistakes in writing my resume, but it was good enough to get me several interviews and then the job offer that I ultimately got. I think like there were two things that I kind of struggled with. The first was deciding whether or not I wanted to continue working with children, because my PhD is in developmental psychology. And I was like, well, I could be research scientist or like doing something in like ed tech if I wanted to keep working with kids, or I could just go and do research somewhere else. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was a little worried that if I wasn't going to working with kids anymore, then I would just not enjoy my job. But I found that that's not true. And I guess what I realized is I like the research process more than any specific research question, but I know for other developmental psych PhDs, working with kids is like more important to them than like doing research. And so it's, I didn't really have a great answer to that question, but the hardest thing for me was, it was more like the emotional transition was harder for me than like making a resume or interviewing or anything like that. It was going from being like, I'm an award-winning expert in my field to like, now I'm at an entry level position and I'm kind of starting over. And did I just waste like an entire decade of my life? And also I'm getting paid so much more to be doing so much less work and trying to get over this. I don't actually need to work all the time and trying to recalibrate. Okay, what does my life look like now?
What do I like to do? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, what do I like doing in my free time? And this is what it feels like to just not be like, worrying if I'm doing enough work or if I'm good enough, like all the time, and that kind of emotional transition. And also the transition from I am doing everything by myself to I'm working in a team of people. And like, I have one portion of this larger project, but I didn't feel like that transition was as hard for me because I wasn't a professor. So I didn't really feel like I had full autonomy over my research questions anyway. I was always having to run things by my advisors. So in terms of autonomy, that's kind of the amount that I have now. I still run things by my managers, but I also have a lot of autonomy to write up things how I want or design and studies how I want and whatnot.
So did you have a period of grieving over your academic career?
Yeah, definitely. And I initially was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna like keep collaborating on these projects, finish up these papers, and was very, oh yeah, I'm definitely not going anywhere. I'm still gonna collaborate. And then as I got further and further away, I'm like, I just don't care. Like I have papers, literature reviews that are unfinished. I have study ideas that I'm happy to give to someone else if they want. Like I wrote a 5-year grant that those studies, I'm never going to do them. Yeah, but grieving that part. And then also just like so many other things were changing in my personal life. I moved states multiple times and, you know, was changing jobs multiple times. And it was just like a big period of change. There's definitely like some grief involved and maybe more just like bitterness.
A bit, that right?
Over the past few years, which I think was bitter also in part because as I became more popular in social media, I'd have a lot of people reach out to me telling me the worst possible stories you can imagine about their academic experience. Because I am like a pretty vulnerable person and like I can hold space for a lot of people. And I think people felt safe disclosing all this to me, like a stranger, because they didn't have anyone else they could talk to. And a lot of people were like, this is when I'm going through my advisor, like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
What should I do? And so I've just heard probably like the worst stories you can imagine, every department, every university, every country. And I'm just, wow, this problem is worse than I thought. So I feel like I did get like really bitter. Then also couple that with being on academic Twitter as my account got more popular, getting backlash and harassment from like academics. And I was like, wow, this is not really what I expected.
Did you get blamed for the postdoc crisis? And because I really feel like this is ridiculous.
Yeah, I think once I started working at Meta, I think people were like, okay, well, you've just sold your soul to a big tech company. And then I think when I really got into Twitter notoriety, I was like, here's my postdoc salary. Here's what I'm making a year later at Meta. It is 3 times as much money. And that was, I think, very jarring for people. And then there was all this discussion about, like, well, no one's in academia for the money. And money has always been this really big sticking point. Yeah, I think when I got into coaching and started charging, I met with a lot of people for free to the point where I had to start saying no to people because I just didn't have time. So back in September of last year, I was like, okay, if people want to meet with me, like they can pay like a small amount of money to meet with me. And then I developed a coaching program that I started charging for. And I tried to keep this really affordable because I remember like how little money I made in academia. But the sheer act of charging for anything, people have just like come at me for that.
Really?
Yeah. That's been really surprising to me. I think in academia, we're expected to do so much labor for free that when you start being like, actually, no, my time and my labor is
like
not
value
free.
Yourself.
It's valuable. Then I know people are like, no one needs coaching. Like, you can figure this out on your own. Sure, I did. But it's just I don't know. I think there's like a really big misunderstanding and some view that you're doing it for like personal financial gain. And I'm like, I just want to help people. I could just not do this because it's actually taking up a lot of my time when I could just be like...
Exactly. A lot of your efforts, research into this.
I could be like reading a book or something. Yeah.
I mean, you're anyway doing a lot for free. Come on. Everything that you share out of your personal experiences, it's a mine of information, honestly. So yeah. you don't even have to do that.
Yeah, I think it's just interesting. And I, you know, I've talked to like other coaches in the space. I know basically everyone now on LinkedIn. And it's interesting, you know, some people were in the space and they ended up leaving because of all of the negative feedback. And I found that fortunately, like almost everyone who does PhD coaching who I've met is really nice. Or some people I've met who are not and still have this very like competitive mindset that's like a carryover from academia.
Yeah.
But it's interesting and like kind of tough space to be in. But I'm in it because people kept asking for my help and I just have a hard time not helping people if they need help.
So after academia, are you running it yourself? Is it just you in your after work time, basically?
Yeah. So I started by offering like one-on-one meetings. And then in November of last year, I put out a call being, does anyone want to like work with me? And then almost 200 people responded to me and wanted to work with me. I was like, oh, wow, that was really surprising. I was like hoping for 10 people. I started this program. I capped it at 50 people. It was going to be a 3-month program. And every week for the first like 8 or 9 weeks, I was doing a webinar on a different topic, kind of walking people step by step, how does this job search process work? And then a few weeks ago, well, I guess in January, I basically took all the webinars, condensed them into a 2-hour course. And so now that is kind of the cornerstone of my program. So there's a course, but there's also a community and there's like 65 people in it now. And so I just moved weekly pricing so people can come in and pay. It's $50 a week to come in and take the course and get coaching from me. And people can stay for as long as they want or need. And then after that, if people feel like they've gotten the value and they understand, okay, this is how I get a non-academic job. I've had a few people who actually like have offers now or people in final stage interviews and people can kind of go off on the rest of their lives.
And you're not hooking them for a long time.
And I think like, because I got all of my non-academic jobs in like about 2 months each. So if you like understand how job searching works and you understand what employers are looking for and how to write a resume and how to interview and how to network, which is the most important part, then you can make this transition like more quickly. But I think people struggle for such a long time because, you know, they've converted their CV to a non-academic resume. I've viewed a lot of resumes now that are not really how a resume should be. And then they're just sending out these applications, like applying to everything, not hearing back. And then they just do this for months and months. And it's just not how job searching works. And I think once you learn about how job seeking actually works, then you can start to figure it out and just do these more effective strategies that will allow you to pivot more quickly.
Austria is quite surprising for me because apparently here there's even a term that is called vitamin B, which is Bekanntes in German, which means colleague or friend. And basically a term functions to mean that 70% of jobs are really gotten through network and not even like they are not even advertised oftentimes. You just get them because someone recommended you or they saw you somewhere. And to me, when I was thinking I will finish my PhD or I will not, I was at the point where I got to this ultimatum stage and I kind of had to push. I was already decided that either I get my date of defense or I go. I started to look and I was super confused. And then everybody was telling me, you know, you need to have connections. Of course, I do know people, but it's mostly academic people. And I was freaking out. I was like, what will I do? How do I go about this? And in the end, I got my job through network. I didn't even send one resume. Someone recommended me for a job that I really wanted to have in the end, but just by chance. And I was really surprised. It was also not because of my academic work, but actually because of the podcast. It was someone who I interviewed for the podcast who recommended me. So such a, you know, lucky strike.
Yeah, I have a very similar story for how I got my job too. I mean, it was about a year ago. I just started posting on LinkedIn. I think now my manager, Jonathan, sent me a connection request because I was talking about my work at Meta. Mm-hmm. And he was also working in augmented reality at my current company. And he sent me a connection request. And he was like, oh, it's really cool to see what you're doing. I'm like, yeah, thanks, Jonathan. And then several months later, after I posted about the layoffs, I'm like, I don't really know if I like want to stay at Meta yeah. or if I can stay at Meta. And he commented on my post and he was like, you know, smaller company, more stable, better fit. I'm actually hiring right now. And I'm like, I sent him a message cool. like, hey, what's up with this job? Yeah, the job ad he sent me, it was for like a senior engineering position. I was reading the job ad. I'm like, I don't think I'm qualified for this. It was saying they wanted like 5 years of experience in a highly regulated industry. And I was like, Jonathan, I don't have this experience. He's like, your experience in academia counts. You are the hiring manager. Like, I will not argue with you. So I went through the interview process for the senior position. As I thought, I was not quite qualified yeah. for that. But then they offered me like an associate position instead because they really wanted to hire me. And I think, you know, if I had just submitted my resume to this job ad, you would have looked at my resume and been like, this person yeah. is not yeah. qualified for this job. But because I had been posting on LinkedIn and had met the hiring manager who wanted to hire me, like that didn't really matter.
Yeah, that's true. I was shocked, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, same.
I didn't become as public as you, but at some point at the end of my PhD, I was asked to give an interview about being chronically ill and doing a PhD. And yeah. I was really struggling whether or not to do this because I was like, what if it kills my prospective job opportunities? You know, I was still kind of yeah. not sure what I'm going to do, but you can Google and then you see this. And then I was like, do I even want to work for someone who would not hire me because of this? I realized that actually maybe it's even better because it saves me the drama and the experience of finding out that someone would treat me differently because of that. Mm-hmm. And I thought the same when I saw that you were sharing about being neurodivergent. I mean, I know that mm-hmm. now it's not such a stigma, thank God. But yeah. it's still, you know, something that can become a little bit of a struggle for people, whether or not to share and whether or not to be upfront. But on the other hand, I guess if you get a good employer, you can still mm-hmm. kind of work out some solutions that are better for you if you are upfront yeah. about this, right?
I mean, this kind of just happened like a few months ago because what had happened is I had seen other people posting about having ADHD on LinkedIn. Several posts where I was like, oh, that's so cute. That sounds like me. And I would just comment on people's yeah. posts and they were like, you might want to get like assessed for this. And then I started reading more about like ADHD and autism. And I was like, oh my God, how did I miss this? Because my PhD is in developmental psych and it's in emotional development specifically. But I think like a lot of the signs of autism and ADHD, they're really based on boys and how like those presentations are in boys, not taking into account that women and like non-binary people will like mask really heavily. And then when I made this post, like I actually had like someone on my team reach out to me and they were like, oh, I actually like was just recently diagnosed with ADHD too. And I was like, oh, like, yay. I was like, help. Like, I'm trying to like work with my brain more instead of like fighting against it. But, you know, one thing I'm realizing now is meetings are really hard for me. Mm-hmm. And I have like a lot of meetings. I have some like auditory processing disorder where it's just, I will listen to things at 2x speed, like podcasts and stuff, because that's the only way I can like pay attention. So having a meeting with like multiple people, yeah. my brain can have a really hard time focusing. So I'm trying to think of what kind of accommodations can I request to actually like make this easier for me. But that's been kind of what I've been struggling with and thinking about like the past few months.
But people usually try to be accommodating, right? This is what I found most surprising, because I was kind of assuming people will not want to accommodate, let's say, my condition or something mm-hmm. someone else's. I'm quite a bit more inspired by the fact that people try to be more accommodating.
And I think like I've realized like in life in general, they're really afraid of asking for what they need or want because they're afraid of being rejected. But at the same time, people can't give you what you need or want unless you're asking for it. So
totally.
It's kind of like most of the time people want to help you. And if people say like, no, I don't want to be accommodating, then there's not really someone you like want in your life or someone you want to work with, which is hard when you don't have a job. And I think people are like, well, I would just take a job anywhere. But a job is not worth your mental health at the end of the day. And I try to tell this to people in academia.
Yes.
Like,
I think it's important to realize. I think it's something that I realized way too late. And yeah. I also try to talk to people about this. I found it, as you said, like a lot of people reach out to you when they know that something happened to you. And what happened to me then resonated with people, let's say, in a closer proximity, but also through the internet. Mm-hmm. And then people try to ask you. And of course, you take it to yourself. And then you feel like you want to fight for them, but you have a certain mm-hmm. limited capacity.
Yeah.
But I think one of the key points that I would like to convey to people is that, first of all, transition is possible. Mm-hmm. And it's actually not as hard as it could be painted in the academic surroundings. Yeah. And the second thing is that your life is, you know, yours, and you have to...
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the basic questions that get us. I was asked by someone, when was the last time I felt happy? And I realized it was like before I started my PhD or something. I was like really ridiculously ashamed to answer. Because I realized that I just work and I didn't do anything. And when I finished my PhD in September, I was a mess. I had like PTSD and I was struggling to figure out what I liked doing.
Oh, yeah.
Before I started, do I still like this? Am I still the same person? So,
yeah.
I think I strayed a bit. But I think what I like about your story and why I wanted to bring you here and ask you all these questions is that, of course, you have a way to share your experience and this is already helpful to people. But what mm-hmm. I like is that you don't stop and just, you know, saying, oh, this worked for me and academia mm-hmm. is bad.
Yeah.
Everything outside academia is great. You're trying to help people. And
yeah,
I really love that. And
thank you. I'm glad that you like see that, because I think I've had people tell me like that I am anti-academic or like I think academia is awful. And I definitely like I don't believe that. I think the working conditions in academia aren't great for people unless you're like tenured faculty. And even then, I actually work with several tenured faculty right now who are in the process of leaving academia, because I know you think you get tenure and like everything's great. But I have people who have been faculty members for 20 plus years and they're like, I'm actually done. I don't want to do this anymore. But yeah, it's just, I don't know. I really like believe in the ideals of academia and like being a professor, like being a thought leader and like mentoring people, creating knowledge, running my own lab, like all of that still sounds really amazing. But it was just the reality of the situation just didn't match up with what I thought it would be. I wish we could like improve things, but the problems are so deep and systemic that I just don't think anything's going to get better until like more people leave, unfortunately.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the culture is toxic, mm-hmm. or at least it's ancient. And without a strong push, there will not be a revolution, right? I mean, we see this mm-hmm. kind of like you said, there are strikes, there is the postdoc crisis articles in all of the journals. Yeah. But the truth is that it's still so antiquated, it will not get better without a very strong shake of the whole structure.
For sure, yeah.
But speaking up is making a difference, I think. And I am very grateful to you, honestly.
Oh, thank you.
I think what I would like to ask you now is more future centered, because mm-hmm. you are working. You said you like the job that you're doing. You're also mm-hmm. doing the coaching, which I guess gives mm-hmm. you the mentoring aspect that you liked. You can kind of transfer it mm-hmm. out.
Yeah.
So what would be the dream for the next few years, let's say? And what would be the kind of dream, you know, like the big dream?
I know. I've thought about this. You know, a lot of folks have asked me, like, are you going to go into coaching full time? And that was like never really my intention. To not be like a scientist anymore feels really hard for me. I kind of want to believe that I can like do it all. And I think like in this early, I guess like startup life, for a lack of a better description, it is a lot of work right now. And this has kind of become my like Seattle winter project, because the weather here is like awful in the winter. And like, I'm totally fine like being inside and like working on this. But you know, when the summer comes, I don't really want to be working this much. So my intention for the next few months is to get things at a more, develop more like systems and processes to where I'm not working so much on everything. But I guess I kind of see like two ways from the coaching business. I would love to continue to like scale this to some point that like feels like good to keep like helping people to come up with like better systems for creating content, because that does take a long time. I'd love to be more active on Instagram because I'm just, I like have an Instagram and I'm just barely use it because it's three different platforms that all have very different modes of expression. But I'd love to this year start making more video content. I think video content is going to become more of a thing. You'll see this from a lot of other people this year. It's hard to get to know someone just over like words. I think when people talk to me face to face, they're just like,
There's a shift.
They're like, oh, you're actually like a fun person to talk to. And I'm like, oh no, do I not come across as fun in my posts? So they're just like, you just seem very smart and kind of like intimidating. I'm like, oh, I don't know.
I didn't get this impression. Maybe I should reread your posts.
I mean, yeah, when you don't hear anyone's voice or like see anyone's faces. Yeah.
It's hard to say whether they're approachable.
But then I keep calling it like my big girl job instead of my like a side job. I really would love to be promoted to senior engineer. That's something I'm like working on right now. And actually today is 5 months in my job. I've learned a ton and it is starting to make more sense. But yeah, I just wrote a usability plan today, which I had never done, or not today, but like in the past week, which I had never done before. And that was like, oh wow, this is like a lot of, I don't know. I really like it. So I'd love to continue working on these projects and like leading projects. And I think for that job, the big tension for me is like, do I want to stay in this individual contributor track and go to senior engineer, principal, and then it's like staff engineer is kind of like where that tops out. Like, do I want to do that? Or do I want to go into management, I don't know, that would mean more meetings, which I have a really hard time with meetings. And it'd also be like getting a little more divorced from the research process.
Yeah, it becomes more administrative in some sense.
Yeah, which like, I don't know. I really like designing studies, maybe not so much collecting data, designing studies, analyzing and writing up the results and presenting it back. So I don't really know like what will make sense for me long-term. But other than that, I was actually just talking with a PhD the other day who has left academia, and he writes like a really great newsletter. His name is Joshua. It's called The Recovering Academic. And I was talking to him about, I'd love to write a memoir at some point. Like, that sounds fun. That sounds really daunting.
Interesting.
So I'm going to talk to him and like maybe work with him and get like some coaching on. I have a newsletter that I just started.
Oh yeah, I just signed up. I will put a link for it in the podcast description.
I'm like, I need to send that out today. I'm trying to like do one issue every Sunday, getting more of like a content creation writing habit and things like that. So yeah, writing a memoir. And then other than that, I'd love to buy a house in Seattle.
Oh wow.
Which like to be fair is like one of the big reasons I like started the side thing, because I was like, it would be nice to have some extra income because housing here is so expensive. But yeah, those are like my big plans. I'd also love to travel more. Actually, about a year ago, I did my first solo trip to South America. I went to Ecuador, Peru, and Colombia. Life-changing. And I was like, wow, I would really love to do more of that.
It's good. I mean, at least now you feel like you have mental capacity and energy to even form those plans and then follow up on them, for me was big thing. I don't know. I feel like I want to ask you one more thing. Which kind of was prompted by your answer. So you said that you want to do the kind of job you do because there are parts of academic research that you wanted to transfer out. So you want to have certain pieces of that. I want to ask you, do you still kind of love science? Is the tiny Ashley who loved science at first, and is she still there?
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. I mean, the first career I ever wanted was to be an astronaut. I thought Sally Ride, she was like my idol. I thought she was like the coolest person ever. And so I really was really fascinated by science from like a really young age. And like I do some science in my coaching. I'm still doing like market research and UX research and like talking to people and figuring out like, what are people's problems and how can I solve them? And I'm doing product development, but I'm like the person doing everything.
You applied a scientific method to whatever you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do enjoy that, but I don't know, I really like writing. I wrote a bunch of research papers, and you know, every time I sit down and I get to like write a protocol or write a report, I'm just like, oh yeah, I would not really get to do this if I just left science and went into like content creation full time. And you know, fortunately I work really quickly, so I get a lot of like people are like, how do you
you're very productive so I must say. Yes.
Yeah, I think I had like the ADHD,
but you sleep, right?
I do sleep, but I think when I like get into these really intense hyper focused states when I'm really interested in something, and so I can just work
and not be distracted and get a lot more work done
than maybe like other people if they're not as interested in something. So I use that to my advantage often. I really hope that I can figure out how to like do it all and still like have space to, you know, exercise and sleep and do all of that. But I do sleep. That is important.
Okay, to close, I decided this season to ask all of my guests for book recommendation, because I'm a very avid reader and I want to dabble a bit into talking about books as well in the podcast, but yeah. I just want to make a bit of a reading list from people. Yeah. It doesn't have to be science related, but it can be, of course.
Yeah. Oh, well, I feel like my books fall into like one of several categories. It's like I have my poetry books, and then I have like my business books, and then like self-help books.
Okay, so what, let's say a general book recommendation that you think people should pick up.
I have like a stack of books I'm looking at over here. General book recommendations. Well, the last fiction book I read, because I don't really read much fiction, it was Iron Widow, which is a young adult novel.
Are you familiar
with this book?
Yes, it's a good book. Recent scandals around this. I don't know if you've heard.
I don't know. I think like with the author.
I think they didn't get nominated for one of the big, I think it was Hugo awards that is given for fantasy. The whole ceremony was supposed to happen in China, and apparently they excluded her from the selection.
Oh, wow.
Just because also Rebecca F. Kuang, whom I adore, was also excluded. So it was like a big scandal. Haha, way to not explain the scandal. Briefly, the Hugo Awards are one of the key awards for fantasy and sci-fi, and the Hugo Awards ceremony last year was held in China, and it turned out that several authors, including Xian Zhao Shao, the author of Iron Widow, and for instance Rebecca F. Kuang, got excluded from being nominated, supposedly for not qualifying, but then it became clear that they were actually excluded for political reasons or supposed political reasons, namely the content of the books or their social media presence could potentially become an issue or be considered as incendiary in China. So basically it ended up being a case of overcorrection from the side of the Western organizers rather than pressure from the Chinese side. Feel free to check it out. It was covered by Guardian, for instance. But the most important thing is have a look at the book. Have a look at Iron Widow. So I heard about the book. I haven't read it yet.
Yeah.
Is it good?
It's a young adult book, but apparently like the original draft was definitely like NC-17. Uh-huh. Like pretty, because I was reading this and I was like, oh, wow, this is like a pretty intense young adult book. But I mean, I loved it. I was like, this is great. But I don't read much fiction because like I said, I'm usually reading business related books. I just finish reading, I'm like looking over here, this is the book I'm reading right now. Alex Hormozi, I just read like his first book. It's basically about like creating offers, so it's like a business related book, but I learned a lot. Right now I have like a lot of people who reach out to me and ask for help, but it's the process of getting people who they're interested in you but they're like not buying from you yet. How do you like nudge them along so that they will buy from you?
It's not easy.
So I'm learning a lot about sales and marketing, and it's actually like it's just a lot of human psychology at the end of the day. I think academics, when they hear sales and marketing, they like bristle
right away.
This is gross. And I did too until I realized like, oh wait, this is just psychology. I'm a psychologist. And so it's been really fascinating to think about how do you convince people to like buy things. Yeah, it's
without
really,
being
it's
shady,
really
right?
Slow process. Yeah.
Yeah, I get it.
It's fascinating. I've interacted with a few people now who are like really good at sales and make sales seem very effortless and not like high pressure and not salesy. And this is how a couple coaches got me to work with them. And I'm just like, I'm watching them sell their programs to me. And I'm like, you make this look so easy. And I'm like, you've convinced me that like you can help me solve my problem. I think that's something I'm working on for this year as well, is how to be like a better marketer.
It's good. I feel like, yeah, I was worried when you leave academia, you stop learning and you don't. But actually, I've been learning so much. Like,
oh yeah,
it's a different kind of job, but you still can find new things to learn. And I think this is something that people should understand, that you may think that when you're ambitious, leaving academia means that you will suddenly stop. But you can just apply this to any other part of your life or other career.
Oh, yeah.
And it will still work well.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what I've realized about, you know, starting this business and like learning so much is that I think a lot of PhDs who feel really drawn to the academy and being professors, I think they would make really great small business owners, because it's like a lot of the same thing where, you know, you're trying to figure out like, what can I do that will get funding or make money? Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do I recruit people and all of this? And you get like a lot of the autonomy, you get mentorship. I hope that more PhDs will choose business or choose coaching. I found like everything I imagined that I thought I'd like about being a professor, I have like found developing this coaching program. Yeah, I've actually talked to like several PhDs who they were like, what you do seems so cool. I like really want to do it. And I'm like, there's literally like nothing stopping you. There's so many PhDs who need help. I think we'll see more and more. I hope like more and more PhDs who are getting into coaching and who are like becoming more specialized, because I think I think that's kind of what's needed. Like, what if we had a PhD who was like really coaching people how to get into data science or coaching people how to get into instructional design? Because what I do is really general, because I'm not going to coach people again to UX research, because that market is trash right now. And I'm like, I can tell you what to do, but like, I'm not going to advocate that you go into that career right now.
Well, I could talk with you for much longer, but I don't want to keep you. Before you leave, okay, last thought to share to people, just in general, whatever you want to say. And also, please say where to find you.
Yes, you can find me on the internet everywhere.
She's very clearly findable.
I mean, literally, if you just Google my name, Ashley Ruba, everything comes up there. But I'm most active on LinkedIn. I'm also on Twitter. I go back and forth between like how active I am on there, but most of the time you'll find me on LinkedIn. I'm also on Instagram, not as much, but hopefully we'll become more active there. I have a newsletter, which you can also find on both LinkedIn and actually everywhere. There's links to it. But last piece of advice, I think like the biggest challenge that PhDs face in their non-academic job search is probably the biggest challenge that everyone faces, is just lack of confidence in yourself.
Definitely.
People just get in their own way so much with these limiting beliefs about, I'm like overqualified for jobs, or I'm underqualified, or I'm bad at networking, or I'm a failure for leaving academia. And if you really buy into these beliefs, and if you don't adopt a growth mindset and be like, yeah, I'm not great at networking, I've literally never done this before, so like how could I possibly be good at it? But I can learn how to do it. You know, if you want to go into content creation, like you can learn, you can literally learn anything. Like PhDs are expert learners. We learn very quickly. So I think I really try to push people to adopt more of a growth mindset and like a more open mindset than I think a lot of folks have. Because if you can't advocate for yourself, if you can't sell yourself, if you can't put yourself out there, if you don't believe in yourself, no one else is going to believe in you. And no one is going to hire you to do a job if you don't believe that you can do a job. So I think like that's the biggest thing that people need to like wrap their heads around, is just like get out of your own way. Fake it till you make it, because I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I have so much imposter syndrome. Maybe that doesn't come across in my posts and stuff. I don't know what I'm doing. And like, no one really knows what they're doing. Everyone's just kind of doing the best that they can.
Yeah,
and I think that's what you
adulting.
Realize.
Adulting. That's a good message. I would say I'm signing under this, both my hands.
Yes.
This was definitely the biggest problem for me. But as you said, you have to be your own champion, because no one else will. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ashley.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure, and it was really great chatting with you.
Oh, thank you.
And good luck with everything.
Yeah, you too.
Ciao.
Bye.